You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
This episode of Uncorking a Story is brought to you by Mike Carlin's latest novel, The Ruin of Souls. Do you like naughty romance novels? Well, if you do, that's too bad, because this isn't one of those. However, if you like a psychological thriller with puzzles to solve and plot twists that will leave you speechless, you are going to love The Ruin of Souls. It's the perfect accompaniment to that beach vacation you put off last year, and you can pick it up wherever books are sold. Enjoy the show. Well, hello, and welcome to Uncorking a Story, where we uncover the stories behind the stories. I'm your host, Mike Carlin, and today, man, am I excited to share with you my conversation with Noel Obeyra about his life, as well as his debut novel, A Past That Breeds. Now, in my conversation with Noel, one of the points he raises was how damaging indifference can be. Now, in our conversation, we were talking about indifference as it relates to the criminal justice system, specifically how African Americans have been treated indifferently by the criminal justice system. And I'm not here to debate that point at all. But I realize that that's not something that all of us can relate to. Not all of us have had interactions with the criminal justice system, but it really got me thinking about how frustrating indifference is, kind of like on a more micro level for me. And let me just give you an example of what I mean about that. Have you ever been with somebody, you know, whether it's a friend you're hanging out with, you know, a spouse, a partner, you know, someone you're in a relationship with, and you've realized that, you know, either you've become indifferent towards them or they've become indifferent towards you. And, you know, it's actually when you're on the receiving side of indifference, it's actually worse in my mind anyway. It's like worse than them actually ignoring you. Like, I'd rather be ignored than be treated as indifferent. Or indifferently. Now, for example, here, just to bring it home, imagine, you know, kind of sitting down and watching TV, and you ask, you know, another person, what would you like to watch? And their response is, oh, you know, it doesn't really matter, you know, and then, you know, they just proceed to do something like stare at their phone or something like that. You kind of want somebody to have an opinion, right? Like, you know, you may not agree on what you want to watch, but at least have an opinion about it. And how about this? You know, where would you like to go for dinner tonight? And the response is, oh, wherever you want to go is fine. I don't know. Doesn't matter. And to me, like, that kind of indifference is infuriating, you know, I can't even speak today. It's a good thing I write. I have to really speak for a living. But it makes me think, like, I'd rather be alone than, you know, with somebody who has, like, absolutely zero enthusiasm for whatever we're doing, or no suggestions for doing something else, you know, and in some cases, like being with somebody who's indifferent, you know, makes you feel more alone than actually literally being alone, which is a shame. But you know what? I kind of know something here, and I know that you didn't tune into this podcast to listen to me rant about indifference. You came to hear Noel Obeyra's story, and that's what I'm going to share for you right now. So here it is, without any more pontifications from me, my chat with lawyer, author, and what I discovered, Seinfeld enthusiast, Noel Obeyra.
So I'm from the southeastern part of Nigeria. I was born in Nigeria. I went to school in the northern part of Nigeria, went to, you know, usually it's a British system. So after elementary school, you just go to boarding school. middle school to high school. Through high school is boarding school. So I went to a public boarding school in the northern part of Nigeria. And after boarding school, my family wanted me to come to college in the U.S. My sisters have been in gone to college in Connecticut. So I came out here at 17 to go to college initially, and just ended up staying. I studied economics at SCSU, Southern Connecticut State University, and then I went on to study law at University of Texas School of Law at Austin. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I just continued west to California, because I've always had this attraction to, film and writing. I always knew I wanted to be a writer before I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. So
yeah.
I've always aspired to it, and I've always tried to write, even from when I was in boarding school, trying to write plays for my classmates and I to perform. Given what little material we had in our library that would fit the number of people who were really interested or motivated.
Yeah.
So that's just been the genesis of my coming here.
What was it like going from Nigeria to Connecticut? Because I know, because you've had a few different experiences in the United States, because Texas is different from Connecticut and California is different than Texas. So what was it like when you first, was it your first trip to the United States when you came out here for college?
No, it was my second. I had come for the summer. I've been here for summer vacation the summer before I came. In fact, that was the summer that convinced me to, okay, I should come, because when you hear of what students are struggling with in the U.S., it gave me pause in terms of, working in washing plates in kitchens to make ends meet, not having the permit to work in the first place, and then being broke in the process. I really wanted to do my undergraduate degree in Nigeria at the time. But it didn't quite work out that way. So when I came for vacation, with two of my sisters were already here. When I came, I sort of got the idea that I could handle the stress of it if it so happened. And then the next year I came in for college.
Yeah.
And it was different, I came from a very small town. A boarding school in a very small town at my age, I haven't really started going places myself. And here I was, by myself, sent across the ocean by myself to come here and go to school. I just knew I had to get my act together to be able to survive and meet the objectives that I came here to meet.
Yeah. Yeah. So what drew you to the law as a profession? I mean, somebody with an artistic soul who, wanted to write, you were writing plays and for your classmates and things like that. What was it about the law that drew you to it?
Well, oftentimes most of what we know about the law is the courtroom, and you tend to view it as, oh, that's dramatic, that's really exciting, and you think that would be a more interesting thing to do than perhaps any other profession. So I studied economics, and I just knew, and that was the 80s. Remember the 80s economic situation with all the, with all the cases, insider trading cases, and
sure,
all those things that were happening, and the economists weren't the most revered people in that period. they were just really showing the underbelly of the system at the time, and so it wasn't as attractive. I think for me, what drew me to it was it had a sense that it was a more interesting course of work than economics would be. And I also knew at the time that I really wanted something more of a support system for the career that I dreamed of, which is law, which is writing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to something that I'd have to study all the way to PhD before I started working on what I wanted, I dreamt of. So I went the path of law. My dad was a lawyer, so also that added motivation to it. But mostly I just thought it would be more interesting, more exciting, and to do than the other options I had.
Yeah. So out of curiosity, did you find it to be interesting and exciting or not so much?
Yeah, good question. You know, interesting and exciting, not in the way I expected, not in any way entertaining, you know, but in more frustrating and more serious ways. You know, you drop the ball, somebody suffers. You know, you take it one step too far, and you know, the consequences are huge. You know, I found the study of it really interesting and exciting. That I think matched my expectation in terms of what it would ordinarily have meant to study economics otherwise. The study of law, just, you know, very exciting. And, you know, you're drawn to the idealistic and the, you know, the principles of it that strengthens the system, and then you come out to practice and you realize it just doesn't play out that way. You know, you can't you're not always handed the right case to do those things that you're taught in law school to do.
And I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. You're dealt a certain hand, and that's what you go with.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, you think of, like, growing up, I grew up in the 1980s, you know, and watching just TV, pop culture, you watch legal shows, you watch things like L.A. Law. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really what the legal profession is not really all about. That most people in I have a twin brother. He's a corporate lawyer. And yeah, he just spends his days writing contracts, and he's always going to closings. Like that's right. What he does. There's no courtroom drama. There's no martini lunches or anything like that.
LA Law was a strong influence in that sense. That there's drama in this. There's excitement and intrigue in this. So go study this, and do it in LA, and then you'd have all the LA lawish sort of things happening.
But not so much.
Not so much, yeah.
So when are you writing during this entire period of your life? You know, when you're an undergraduate studying economics in law school and mm-hmm. then working as a lawyer, are you writing the entire time?
Yes. So mostly, I think the first thing I wrote when I came to the US was a film script. You know, I had this idea that it was the easiest vehicle for making the leap into the entertainment industry. And I wrote that script by the time I was 18, I think, and sent it out. And it's actually still registered with the Writers Guild of that time. Yeah, because that's what you do to protect it. And then... And it's, you know, you send it out and, you know, they say they don't accept unsolicited work. So, so you move on. And then, I just kept writing. I've always wanted to do narrative fiction, but it wasn't really, I had a lot to learn to be able to do that. But, drama, with the teachers I had at the time, it was easier to work with. And then I wrote a play after that while I was in law school. Law school was very busy, so I didn't write much other than short stories. I wrote a few short stories in law school. And then after law school, I wrote a play. And then when I started practicing and just realized, I had practiced for a few years when I just realized this is really not what I set out to do. I better start working on what I set out to do. And that's when I wrote the first, what I thought was the first page of this story, because I was just trying to capture the frustrations of my practice in a way that I felt a lot of legal fiction wasn't capturing. Just like you were saying, those things that happen in courtrooms that are not really interesting or exciting, but you have to do to protect the interest or to solve the case in front of you. I wanted to show those.
Yeah. And so you mentioned that, so this, at this time you're writing sort of the first page of what became A Past That Breathes.
Well, I started it. Yeah. I wrote more than the first page of it, but that was the first time I started the story. And then, I write it and I put it away and I'm thinking it's not good enough. And then you come back to it and keep doing that.
I mean, you have to find that persistence and almost strength to, and confidence to kind of keep going. And, I'm curious as to kind of what was the inspiration for this novel in terms of, you know, when it, you know, the time period in which it takes place and the location where it takes place. I'm curious as to kind of how it all came together for you and the decisions you made to kind of set it where it's set and during that time period.
So, yeah, so I was practicing law in LA and I had started my practice at, I think I was 27 or 28. You know, it was a time when, just shortly after the first Iraq war, jobs were not that easy to come by. I went to school in Texas, before I came out to California to look for it. And worked for a law firm for 1 year, I think. And then that was in Fresno, California, which was in the central part of California.
Sure.
And then I decided to move back to Los Angeles, which is where I wanted to be. And I moved back to Los Angeles, which is where I wanted to be. And then started my own practice. And I was finding that law school doesn't really prepare you to start your own practice. It prepares you to slot into a law firm.
Yeah.
Get sort of an internship there. And then before you actually know what you're doing out there. But I did, and crazy enough, if you put out your shingle, somebody's gonna walk through that door and give you a case you're not prepared to handle, and so you either sink or swim. So I was going through, and I you know, you do your best, you work hard at it, but I was finding that the difficulty or the problems I had with the practice wasn't so much that I wasn't prepared or that I didn't know what I was doing. It was the system itself, because you find a law library and you do your homework, you know what to do, and you take all these seminars and classes that would give you, you know, the how to operate in a courtroom or how to handle certain things. So so I found that, the, you know, especially in the criminal law aspect of my practice, that was a difficult part.
Yeah.
And I think I remember particularly one day sitting in my house just wondering if my classmates from law school are going through the same frustrations and the same things I was going through in terms of what we expected we were going to be doing as lawyers, you know, fighting the good cause, you know, and, you know, pursuing these idealistic principles.
Right.
Or whether they found themselves in the practical midst of it that just doesn't reflect all those things, where you get dealt a certain hand and you have to live with it. And that's when the idea came to me that two classmates from the past ran into each other, and before they found out that they were actually on opposite sides of a murder trial. Mm-hmm. And then in that, you try to reflect what they learned and how it's playing out in their practice. I think that was the idea for the plot came out that way.
Yeah.
But as I started to write it, I'll get into the characters. They just developed on their own.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just curious as to in what ways sort of your experience in Los Angeles, in the early 90s when you were practicing law. And I mean, there was, you know, to say that there was a lot going on, you know, racially is an understatement. You've got, you know, the Rodney King, you know, you got the Rodney King beating and then subsequent verdict. You've got, which kind of feeds into, you know, the O.J. Simpson trial and again, another spark of, you know, unrest, you know, how does that come into play, if at all, in a past that breathes?
Oh, it's huge, you know, because you those become sort of like the background of every case you're handling. When you're representing someone of color who's in the same system. You have this in the back of your mind, and it's not so much the beating, but what the system did with it. You know, the acquittal of the officers, I think, was the biggest frustration that fueled the riots. And then there was another case then that many people didn't know about, which was the Latasha Harlins case, which was a 16-year-old who went to a store and maybe didn't have the money. I don't remember exactly the facts of it, but maybe she didn't have the money to purchase the glass of milk, or the bottle of milk, but it was a bottle of milk that was worth less than $5. And got into an argument with the store owner, you know, slammed the bottle of milk on the counter and trying to walk away and got shot. And she was killed by the, and the security camera caught that. But then the verdict was not anything you would expect. I'm not here saying that the case was tried one way or another, but I'm just saying that the verdict reflected the continuing sense of indifference that, you know, people of color feel that the system has about their own lives. And so you take a case into court, and that's in the back of your mind. You know, this person that just killed a 16-year-old African-American, got some kind of community service and suspended sentence. And you have a client who, you know, stuck his hand in a tiller and took $20. And you're looking at, you know, 2 years felony suspended sentence plus something else. And it's always in the back of your mind. And it's really frustrating when you're trying to make this plea negotiations or figure out whether you're going to trial or not.
Yeah.
So it's hard to escape when you're in the same system that's doing that and representing the same clients of color that feel that the system is being so quite indifferent to them.
You know, and I think that word indifference is so, you know, it's such a, I want to say loaded word, but it indifference is almost worse than, you know, gosh, it's like if you're just indifferent to something, it's just worse than maybe being outright hateful, because it just shows just a lack of, it's really almost a lack of humanity. Because, you know, we all have emotions, love, hate, fear, anger, but indifference is almost a choice. And it's what do you think about that? I see you nodding your head. What do you think about that?
In one sense it is, you know, but I don't mean to say that the judges lack humanity. I think in this sense, especially in the African American context, indifference is also the fact that you don't see what you're being indifferent to. You know, if a child is choking right too much, you know, by my side, and I'm sitting right here and I don't see that child choking and I don't offer any help because I don't see the child choking, I'm indifferent to the child because I've not offered any help. It's happening right, you know, but it is because I didn't see that. And that's sort of that what you see. You find that the system is almost conditioned not to see the struggles that are in front of it. You know, you reduce it to data points, and you're more better able to deal with it in that context without going behind it to see the lives that are involved in it. You know, you reduce it to, how many murders have happened in the black community today, and why am I dealing with this one, and what makes you think this one is different from the others? When you reduce it to those, you know, data points that have that allow you not to look at the lives behind them or the principles that you need to respond to, then you're being indifferent in the worst possible way, like you're saying. But you find that the person will tell you that it's not because they lack humanity, but for most of their life, that's not what they see. They've been conditioned not to see that, but to see the data points and run with it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like data, especially looking at social events at a macro level, is, right. You know, there's a danger there, because you can become desensitized to it. And then the great Freudian defense mechanism of rationalization comes into play, where right. You can rationalize, well, okay, you know, most murders among African Americans aren't, you know, white on black. It's black on black. And that's a statistic that it may be true. The numbers may prove it. But what you miss is, again, the story behind it, and sort of the, you know, almost, I don't even know. I'm at a loss for, as a writer, I'm at a loss for words to talk about right. it. But you're right. When you just look at data and you try to rationalize it, you miss the story, the bigger picture, if you will.
Yeah. It's hard to find somebody who disagrees with the wrong that happened in the case in front of you. You know,
yeah.
How do you find somebody who disagrees with the fact that what Derek Chauvin did was wrong?
Right.
But then but you find somebody who immediately they acknowledge the wrong, they say, but this, but that. And I think a part that breeds is saying, let's pause before the buts and focus on the wrong and what the legal precepts say we should do about the wrong. We deal with the buts later, you know, but I have 30 years of experience and I've been solving cases like this, and I just know that if this is there and that is there, this is where I'm going with it. Yeah, but it is still wrong what you to solve, to not respect the process, to not grant someone their due right in the course of this investigation, so to speak. So you see that a lot, you know, you struggle with that, because I think sometimes the essence of process is the respect for the individual, you know, is the acknowledgement and respect of the individual involved in the case, so that it's not lost in the among the mass of data that you're trying to, you know, slot him into.
As sort of a legal professional, you know, someone who spent 30 plus years in the legal field, were you surprised at all by the Chauvin verdict?
No. I know that at the heart of, I wasn't surprised at all. I think what I would say is I wouldn't have been surprised if it went the other way. Mm-hmm. I wasn't, you know, at the heart of this, you know, this country has wonderful people in it and a great system of justice, if it can just play out the way it was envisioned, if we can just give it a chance to actually work the way it's supposed to work, if we don't worry too much, if we don't jump too much to conclusions and go to the outcomes that are stereotypically driven, the system, I know I have not read of any better system at any point in time, at least to my knowledge. So you always have to believe in the human spirit, in the ability of the human spirit to do the right thing. The ability of individuals, especially with the right information in this country, to do the right thing is immense. But having said that, and there is that but again.
Yeah.
Having said that, the politicization of everything, and the tendency of people to feel that they just have to take one side or the other, or they are, or otherwise they're not in the right place that they're supposed to be. is what makes me say that I would not have been surprised if it went the other way.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, this will be my last question on this topic, but I'm just fascinated since I have you here. Do you think if this were 30 years ago in the 1990s, it would have been different?
It would have been different in terms of the verdict?
Yeah.
I'm inclined to say yes. I'm really inclined to say yes. One, because so two things. Are we assuming that you have the cameras for 9 minutes and 29 seconds focused on him?
Yeah.
One, that's one. And secondly, still a lot of people would not have believed it.
Yeah.
Still a lot of people would not have believed it. You know, even in 19, that far back ago, you wouldn't have the cameras they have now with this brilliant pixels that will capture it. The Rodney King video, for instance, was so grainy, if you recall, that people were actually wondering whether the batons were actually landing on him. And you're wondering, who cares? You know, so you're wondering, well, it didn't really land. Did it really land on him? 50 times? I don't care. A law enforcement, you know, individual is hitting a person who's just been, not even been arrested yet. And we're wondering whether the baton is landing on him to cause any damage and how come he didn't have bones broken and all that stuff. You still had those questions, right? I honestly think the verdict, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm inclined to say that the verdict would have been different. I think I'm inclined to say that the verdict would have been more leaning towards what the verdict in the Rodney King case was and some of those cases.
Yeah. When you were working in you know, the legal profession in Los Angeles, did you have run-ins with the LAPD and what were those like?
No, I had run-ins I lived mostly in a town called Pasadena.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
A few minutes off LA. And so I tended to avoid LAPD for the most part, unless someone called me on a case. So I didn't have direct run-ins with them. I had run-ins with, you know, the other of police services around LA, but nothing as hard or dramatic as what you see in the news. But I also did appeals. So I worked for the California Appellate Project, which is a group that represents indigent criminal defense, indigent individuals who have appellate cases, and I would handle their appeals. And I also did appeals for other lawyers who were trial lawyers and would want their cases appealed. And in the facts of those cases, you're reading the transcript of, and you read, and that's where you see the whole case, like almost like, you know, you're watching a script, and you have the records of the case, and you're looking through it. Granted, hindsight is 20/20, right? But you're reading it, and you're shaking your head, and you see a lot of those run-ins there. But luckily for me, I didn't have much of that happening. Except you'll see instances. I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's
you.
Okay.
You'll see instances where I encounter them and I you know, like they put you through more stress than you that is necessary in a stop, and or they put you're going through a building and they put you more stress than necessary, and you encounter them and you realize you sort of have a sense of what's going on, but it's not worth going into it, and you just ignore it.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've worked in the legal profession for a long time. You've written a crime thriller. The events of your book, I mean, was anything in it sort of inspired by anything that happened to you in real life? I mean, the characters in the book, are they inspired by people you know or real people? Or I'm just curious as to how you went through this whole writing process.
So when I started the book, I was prepared for it not to be published. I mean, like I told you, I've been writing since I came here, and I find almost that I write because I cannot stop writing, because that's you just it feels good to be taking steps towards your dream, and that's satisfying in itself. But you know, with my experience with the first screenplay I wrote, and with my experience with other things I've been writing, I was prepared for this to be one more thing that may not see the light of day. So the first thing it had to do was entertain me in the process. So I was prepared to, I was writing, making sure that I enjoy myself writing it, even if it doesn't see the light of day. So what I would do is all the characters, at least all of the Kenneth's friends, all of the male characters' friends, are real people, real individuals. They were modeled after real individuals. They're fictionalized, but they're modeled after real individuals. And what happened was I actually used their real names in the hope that at the end of the day, just to entertain myself and amuse myself, that I have Mike saying this. I wonder what Mike would say about it, you know. And so at the end of the day, my hope was that I would hit, you know, find and replace, and it would just change the names. You know, I'll make Mike Steven and just find and replace, and it would change the names, and I'll move on. But you keep writing Mike, and Mike develops into, you know, you start to amuse yourself, but then Mike develops into a different entity in itself, and takes you to places where you're going, wow, I don't believe they did this, you know. And then at the end of the day, you find it hard to type Steven and hit find and replace, because this is Mike. It's not the Mike you knew. It's not the Mike you modeled it after. This is an individual. It's almost like you're killing him off, when you do that. So I ended up leaving their real names. I ended up leaving their real names and making it very clear. Right? You can't possibly tell me this is you, because it is completely, it took a life of its own. So that was one aspect of it.
Yeah.
I would say that, a lot of the processes, the legal processes that took place, the legal strategies, the issues about the insurance, the issues about the evidence, those were taken right out of my own cases. Those have very direct correlations. And if you look at apaththatbreeds.com, the website, you would see actual cases that I handled that reflect, that inspired a lot aspects of those cases, of those stories, you know, where those issues came up. And I put those cases there, the ones that went to appeal, because you can literally just click on them and read the appellate issues and find what they, you know. So those were the cases where those issues came up for me, and I just put them back in fiction, and it's actually worked.
Yeah, I know you mentioned sort of, kind of coming out here and writing that screenplay, more than just a couple of years ago, but and not necessarily having success with it, and hoping that this would see the light of day. And I think for many of us who write, and you know, the first thing we write, the second thing we write, sometimes the third thing we write, right, you know, they may never see the light of day, but it takes some kind of energy and confidence to keep going back at it and trying again, you know, getting up on that horse again. And you mentioned before that you still had a lot to learn. And I'm curious about, you know, how you learned those lessons you needed to learn in order to get to the point where, you know, you've got something, you've got something like this book that does see the light of the day, that does get picked up. What were some of those lessons?
I did have a lot to learn. I often say that this book took so long because it is my MFA program in on writing. Because you and also, you know, when you get to a point where one of the things that keep us going, right, is you read a lot, and you've read what's good out there, and you're reading it and you're thinking, you know, my book can read like this. It can, yeah, I can do this. And so you write it, and an editor looks at it and go, you need to throw half of this out. And you're going, what? I read that. It's like, it's not that different from the other book I read. And it's doing really well out there. He goes, no, this is not working. I'm like, these characters are great. This plot is great. This story is great. I think one of the things I learned is you need to get yourself out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, get your ego in check, get yourself out of the way. And begin to understand and actually listen to those who know, who are trying to help you out. I struggled a lot with it because one thing I really wanted to show was how ordinary life affects the criminal justice system, the life of those who are practicing, who are in it. You know, how what's going on in your life affects this. Has consequences for this individual you're representing whose life may be on the line.
Yeah.
And you don't stop your life because you have, you know, one case that needs to go to trial, and you can't completely isolate your life from that. And I wanted to show aspects of that, even in very small instances that may do that. And I tried to do that with this, a couple of the books, and also tried to show, especially how not having the resources, especially in the African American community, affects the kind of representation and justice you might end up getting.
Yeah,
and one of the books I think if I had not read these books, this particular book, Bleak House, for instance, I would not have wanted to write something in the law. But one of the books I read that, for me, resonated with what I was going through in the 1990s. And think about when that book was written, you know, how much, you know, having the resources or how much lawyers with money might think of their clients as just a business rather than an individual that needs representation goes forward. And that was what I was trying to, some of the things I wanted to show. So Knowing that book inspired me. So when they would tell me to cut this out, I was like, no, it's sort of like where this thing was going. That's the type of thing I want to write. And but I started to listen, especially because I would put it away because I just don't like what I've been told about it. And when you step away from it and come back to it, you say, okay, let me just try what they said and see if it works. And I grew that way. I began to understand why they were saying it on a more intellectual level rather than on an emotional level where I'm thinking they're saying I'm not good enough and I don't know what I'm doing. And you grow that way. Like you said, the first thing you write might not make it. The second thing you write might not make it. The third thing you write might not make it. But they are all teaching you, you're growing every single time. And the fourth thing you write was actually good because of those first three things.
Right, right. And this idea of getting yourself out of the way, I think for other authors, and there's a lot of sort of up and coming authors who listen to this. It's, it's so important because you have to realize that number one, you don't have all the answers. Number two, these people, you know, they read, they edit, they make decisions on these things commercially for a living. So they might know something. And number three, we always have to remember that we're the writers, we're not the readers.
Exactly.
So if we're too self-indulgent about it, sometimes it just may not land. I mean, I remember the first book I wrote that, you know, got published and went through the editing process. The editor cut out like a whole piece of it. And I said, why would you do that? This is one of the most important parts of the story, you know? And they're like, no one's going to understand. And it was a comedy and there was a lot of 80s pop culture references in it. And they're like, they're not going to understand the references to all the TV shows you like to watch in the 80s. No one cares about the Love Boat, Mike. And I'm like, I care about the Love Boat. It's important.
Yeah.
But no, they're right.
They're right. I mean, you notice in this particular instance, when they were having dinner at some point, And he says to them, Kenneth says to them, oh, and this nightclub where everybody knows my name, he goes, and the other guy goes, well, what's this nightclub called? Cheers. And and you're right in it. But, you know, that made it because it places them in the 80s, at least. You'd say, okay, these guys are in this time period, and that's usually, if he had gone the way I wanted it to make those jokes, you would have seen it so many Seinfeld references in it, because that's just the stuff that went, the banter that went back and forth during dinner, you know. Not that I'm saying it's wrong.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Wrong with it, yeah. So you just have to get those things out of the way and see what comes out. I learned to get other people, not necessarily the experts, but other people to give you their opinion of it. I remember writing a scene where the female character got to the office and there's a note on her desk and says, "See me at my office by 8 a.m. If you please see me at my office as soon as you arrive." And she kicked off her shoes and walked to the boss's office to see her. And a friend of mine read it and said, "Noel, we don't do that." Because my pantyhose would run so much if I took off my shoes and walked on this carpet to go anywhere. No, we don't do that. And of course, I'm a man writing about a female character. I'm like, thank you for that. And that particular aspect of it went out. So you have to listen. You have to be humble enough to accept that you're to accept that there is so much to learn and to continue to learn. And another aspect of it is that I found that the more mature I got, the more I understood my character's immaturity or their own maturity. You know, there were just aspects of the character that may not have had as much depth as it has now because of my age and how far I've come going forward.
Well, we do have to wrap up here, Noel, but before we go, since you brought it up, I have to ask, what, if any, is your favorite episode of Seinfeld? It's almost like picking from your favorite children if you love the show, because there are so many good ones. But does one, and maybe it doesn't have to be your favorite, the one that's most memorable to you, the one that's just always in the back of your mind.
Oh gosh,
it's good. That's a good one. That's it. I mean, it's a classic. I could see her doing it in my head.
Yeah, you also have to
kicks the foot out.
You and the funny thing is, where did the dance even come from? You know, like the fact that she came up with that particular style, and that it's not like she took something that was in the that's been a dance style in the past and sort of didn't do it well. She just completely created her own. And you're looking at it and going,
I have to say, if you were to ask me that question, which you didn't, but I'll ask it, I'll tell you. It's the one where Jerry becomes friends with Keith Hernandez from the Mets. Okay. And he asks him to move, and then he's dating Elaine. But there's a whole scene where Kramer says he doesn't like Keith Hernandez because he believes he spit on him after a Mets game. And then what happens is Keith is in Jerry's apartment, and he goes through it like, oh no, that wasn't me, that was somebody else. And they do this reenactment of a scene from the movie JFK, and this always stuck. There had to be a second spitter. It's just
yes, that's true. As we're talking about it, remember Kramer being a ball boy at the U.S. Open.
At the U.S. Open. Well, now that you bring up Kramer, the one where he actually goes into an epileptic seizure every time he hears Mary Hart's voice from Entertainment Tonight. That one, That one just always made me laugh.
That, well, they were just so creative and imaginative with that program. Yeah.
Oh, it was good. But this, and you've been creative too, because you have a brand new book out called A Past That Breeds, which was published on June 15th. And, yeah. You know, where do you, you know, where would you tell people to go buy that, Noel?
Oh, it's online on Amazon. It's on Redbirds, my publisher, redbirdslate.com. It's everywhere. I've just been so blessed that it's available everywhere good books are sold. And it's also on eBooks and Kindle.
Well, very good. Very good. With that, I wish you all the best with the launch of this book, and I'm sure you're doing a lot of these types of conversations, and but this was fun. I enjoyed getting to know you and talking to you.
Same here. Same here. Thank you so much. And thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, there it is. My conversation with Noel O'Byra about his life and his debut novel, A Past That Breeds. You know, I just wanted to hug him. No, he just said a gentle man. You know, I wish we could have been in the same room, because it would have been nice just to kind of be in his presence. He's very, very calming. His voice is so calming. Maybe I shouldn't hug him. I don't know. The COVID is still happening, right? I mean, I'm vaccinated. I'm assuming he is. So maybe we could have hugged. I mean, we could have shaken hands, right? Shook hands. Is that the right term? Shook. Could have shook. Fist bumped. Maybe we could have done that. Anyway, as I was mentioning, his debut novel, A Past That Breeds, can be purchased wherever books are sold. And you know what? That's true. That is absolutely true. It can be purchased wherever books are sold. But I have an idea for you. And my idea is to show some love to those independent bookstores of the world, right? They can use our help. If you must buy it online, fine. But consider doing so at bookshop.org. Where a portion of every sale, and I don't know how they do this, but a portion of every sale is shared with small independent bookstores. So that's a good idea, right? Help them out. It's tough times out there for small businesses. And, you know, you might, as David Byrne from the Talking Heads would say, you might ask yourself, how can I find more of these Uncorking a Story interviews? Well, I've got good news for you. You can go to mikecarlin.com and check the archives, and that's C-A-R-L-O-N. .com, because, you know, the people at Ellis Island had to throw people off. But you can go there, check out the archives. While there, you could, sign up for a mailing list and check out a few of my novels, which are great summer reads. Now, lastly, and this would mean the world to all the men, women, and dogs who work for Uncorking a Story, and yeah, we have two dogs working here. Please go to wherever you get your podcast and rate and review us. That really does help us with rankings and getting the word out about Uncorking a Story. And to that end, you know, feel free to share this episode or any episode of Uncorking a Story with a friend. We love it when you do that. And if you're so compelled, go to wherever you get those podcasts and subscribe so you can stay up to date with the latest and greatest coming from Uncorking a Story. And there are some great episodes coming up. So that is my sales pitch. It is now officially over. And this is Mike Carlin. I don't even know my name anymore. This is Mike Carlin, host of Uncorking Story, saying thanks for listening. And until next time.